Let's talk.
John Brown. The dogs of Mariupol, Russia's invasion and the forging of Ukraine's Iron Generation, is an updated version. We spoke to Tom Much, the author of The Dogs of Mariupol, a little bit earlier. I think it was in this year. Delighted to have him back on. Thomas, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure's mine. We last spoke, what was it, 6 months ago? Perhaps a little bit longer than that?
No. It was earlier. It was earlier than that. It was around the time of the law of the original launch. So about 2 months ago,
I think. See, doesn't time fly when you're having, I was going to say fun, but not particularly that.
It's been a long 2 months.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, due to events that are happening worldwide, for a lot of people, Ukraine has gone onto the back burner. Certainly not in my universe. But it is timely that we have you back on. What has been happening since you relaunched the book 2 months ago, 3 months ago, and, the updated version that you're bringing us? Tell me a little bit about that as well.
So, all right, what's happened in Ukraine is, I think, quite important to go through first. I'm afraid, even with my ego, it's more important than my book. So Ukraine has actually seen probably the most significant domestic political, I don't want to say strife or turmoil, because that slightly overplays it, but it's seen a lot of political unrest based on a law that was supposed to be passed, or that did pass but now might be reversed, that's supposed to neuter the independence of some of Ukraine's anti-corruption agencies. And you can probably see them in Kyiv now.
Yeah,
there were tens of thousands of people marching down the streets, and not just in Kyiv, but in Kharkiv and Odessa, Lviv, basically everywhere in the country, protesting this bill and protesting for the government to remove it. Now, I want to make two things clear, because when we think of mass protests, we often think that that's a total loss of legitimacy in the government, and that isn't really the case here. Very few people were calling for Zelensky's ouster. Very few people were calling for, a surrender deal to the Russians or for immediate elections or anything like that. Not even Zelensky's personal political rivals were calling for anything like that. But I think it's worth also noting that these protests were very well organized, but also extraordinarily peaceful. And, there was no looting, there was no rioting, there was no... People were worried about even stepping on the wrong blade of grass. That's why people sort of marched into the streets and wouldn't even, walk on the grass in the parks or anything like that. So well organized were they. So I think that's one thing. The front line has more or less continued as not quite stabilized, but marginal Russian gains for extraordinary cost.
Yeah.
They've managed to make some, after sort of bashing their head against a wall in Pokrovsk for nearly 10 months now, they have managed to make some minor inroads into the south of the city. More worryingly, they seem to be able to go up to the northeast, and they're kind of trying to go around it and rather than storm the city, just cut it off and cut all supply routes open that are still open to the city off. There's a big battle going on near a town called Rodinskoye. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Elsewhere, the Russians aren't doing, outside of Donbass, that's the only fear of the Russians are really making any major gains. Their advance in Sumy Oblast has been pushed back, and they also have tried to make gains in Kupiansk, in the Kharkiv Oblast,
yeah,
but gotten back. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because a couple of things off the back of that is, one, Donbass is always, that's, if you like, there is Russia, there is sort of Russians, there's a Russian leaning to it. Can we say that? It's always been the Donbass region had its Russian supporters at the time. I mean, going back to 10 years ago, or am I completely off out of touch with that one?
No, that's not entirely incorrect.
Right.
So it's hard to get good details about this, but yeah. I think the leanings were that, according to polling, from around about the time, there were probably about 25 to 35% of the population who either were pro-Russian in the, you know, to a fairly solid degree. And now also I think pro-Russian is sometimes misunderstood as we hate Ukraine, we want it to be taken over by Russia.
Yeah.
There were quite a lot of people in Ukraine who genuinely thought, at least before the full-scale invasion, Ukraine and Russia have a lot of cultural, political, economic similarities, and Ukraine should orient itself towards Russia as an independent state. And there were certainly plenty of people in Donbass who felt like that. A minority, but not an insignificant minority, genuinely wanted outright independence or to join Russia. And for that reason, I think Donbass has always been during this war the part of the country that the Russians have been the most successful in. It's the most politically important for them, because they're whole war was supposed to be about saving the Donbass, despite the fact that they absolutely, you know, raised the Donbass to the ground with artillery and missiles and glide bombs.
As they said in Vietnam, to save the town, we had to destroy it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, we made it a desert and we called it peace. And you look at the Bakhmut or Mariupol or Vuhledar or any of those towns that have just been absolutely, you know, wiped out of existence.
The other thing is the fact that, you see, there are certain forces here and certain people who go, you see, the problem with, and I, you know, I did a phone-in show on a Tuesday mornings called Viewpoint, and people are saying, you see, the thing is, Zelensky is a dictator. You don't understand. They're fighting a proxy war. It's NATO, etc. Zelensky is a dictator, and he's brooking no argument. And surely the demonstrations that we've seen over the past couple of days, anti-corruption, are proof that there is a democracy. And it's not a democracy that cracks down and beats people after they go on the streets. It is, you are allowed to protest, as you are supposed to do in a healthy, functioning democracy.
And I want to go, if we go back 10 years, right, to the Maidan protests, where you had the pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych, basically a corrupt thug in office, he was beating, the whole reason the Maidan got so big is he sent his thugs, his riot police, on the protesters to beat and burn and throw them in jail. They ended up shooting them towards the end of the demonstrations, and nothing like that has happened in Ukraine under Zelensky at all. I think it's a very odd claim, because it's not really a claim that people in Ukraine make. Zelensky has I'm actually writing, by the way, a piece for my Substack right now. It's called Zelensky: The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly Necessities of War, which is a sort of a detailed analysis of his war leadership, which has, surprisingly, good things, bad things, and ugly things that are kind of, you know, something that looks bad on the surface, but there is a sort of you can kind of understand it once you look deeper. And look, it shouldn't be said that Zelensky brooks no criticism either. Zelensky's actually very open to journalists. He's one of the few, you know, world war leaders who will just call impromptu press conferences where you can ask him anything you like. I've been to two of those, you know, and he takes all questions, you know, with the very, and he takes them seriously, and he answers them. He is a very accessible leader in that fashion, which is, you know, also considering someone who there's, you know, presumably a very big Russian bounty on his head, it's extraordinarily brave of him. And here's the thing. You will never find any of these callers who actually have any experience with Ukraine. They have never been to, they've almost never been to Ukraine, or if they've been to Ukraine, they went 10, 15 years ago. They never speak Ukrainian. They're occasionally, you know, if they're a Russian troll, they might speak Russian. They never speak the languages. They never actually talk to people. It's, oh, I've heard from someone's uncle's cousin whose dog is still in Ukraine that Zelensky's a bad guy, right? Which is, I think, why this narrative frustrates me so much. That's not to say there aren't very genuine criticisms of Zelensky to be made, but it is a good thing that I can press publish on that article and not worry that I'm going to get a knock on my door, you know.
Which is the thing about a democracy. What's the situation now then? Two quick. One in Kyiv, where you are at the moment, because presumably it's still, we've still got the same mayor as had before. There's been no change there. Viktor Klitschko, yeah, exactly. There's no interpolitical fighting between. I mean, they are still a united front against the Russian invasion, presumably.
Well, look, here's the thing. Everything is a united front against the Russian invasion. One thing that Klitschko and Zelensky have had. I know Klitschko a bit. I interviewed him for my book.
Yeah.
They have had definite personal political beef, right? And Zelensky's had personal political beef with a lot of major other Ukrainian politicians, many who despise him. However, to the great credit, I think, of the opposition in Ukraine, they have always kept a united front, right? They have always kept a united front against the Russian invasion and kept their personal problems with Zelensky either behind closed doors or made clear that, you know, that's why none of them are calling for early elections, for instance. And this is interesting because it's been fairly widely reported that the US tried to put pressure on these kind of opposition figures. You know, we're talking about March, or remember when there was that whole big thing about Zelensky's a dictator, we need elections. And none of the major Ukrainian political figures were willing to come out and say that, just because they knew that it was just a ruse to get, to get more foreign influence into Ukraine.
So, what is the situation then in Mariupol? I mean, is there any news coming out of there? What is, because, you know, obviously that was the subject of the Dogs of Mariupol, the reason we call that, and the Iron Generation. I mean, what is the situation on the ground? And what are you feeling, Tom? What are you seeing down there?
So, okay, so just to be clear, nobody can get into Mariupol from Ukrainian territory and have not been able to for a long time. Yeah. Also, in some ways, I somehow think I've missold the book slightly, because the book is a history of the war in Ukraine, yet a lot of people think it's just about Mariupol, which maybe I just need to put like a subheading, right? Like,
well, it's the Iron Generation, isn't it? It's the effect this has had on Ukrainians themselves.
But it is worth talking about not just Mariupol, but the occupied territories in general. Once again, a lot of this information is not just secondhand, but thirdhand.
Yeah.
I've spoken to someone whose parents are still there, for instance, right?
Yeah.
And so, I've written about this in the book in quite a lot of detail. I have a chapter about this, but I've made it clear that a lot of this is secondhand. So, look, the situation in Mariupol. Look, Mariupol was basically destroyed, right? Yeah. Like, it was almost every building was just completely razed to the ground. And one of the things that the Russians have done is they've kind of built like Potemkin neighborhoods, right? You know the concept of the Potemkin village.
Yeah. Show village. Yeah. Here we are. This is what we're doing. Here we, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, you know, they'll bring a visiting dignitary somewhere. It will look absolutely amazing wherever they take them, but they don't go outside of this very, very pre-prepared route. So, yes, there are a few, like, nice apartment blocks that have been rebuilt, and you'll see them. If any videos of Mariupol come out from the Russians, it's always the same two or three apartment blocks, because they're the only ones that are still functioning. It also, you'll sometimes see that, like, you know, some Americans, like Tucker Carlson is a good example, will go to Moscow and be
good,
like,
"Good gods or something, Tom.
This is amazing. There's all these, you know, the supermarkets are well stocked, the metro stations are really nice. I was shown an amazing time." Well, of course you were shown an amazing time, because the Russians do have the ability to make the places that foreigners go to will see look nice. Mm. But now some people still live there. I think the population is probably south of 100,000, but there's still it was a big city before the war. It's 500,000 before the war. And it's probably closer to 100,000 now. Apparently they're selling land for quite cheap to get like Russians to buy up land and then move there, which is one of the that they did, by the way, in Donetsk and Luhansk and Crimea, not even just before 2014, but during the Soviet period, right? That's how a lot of these places became Russified. They just moved a lot of Russians.
The Germans were doing the same thing, you know, in the 30s and the 40s as they expanded their empires, quote unquote. You know, go east, you can have some land. You know, take back your German speaking lands, etc. What's the move, though? I mean, we've mentioned this, and you know, I'm living in the southern Spain, and I still see sort of you know high powered sort of SUVs and Porsche Cayennes with Ukrainian number plates driving around the place.
This is one of the things that there's a lot of tension about. Yeah. To be
explain, Tom.
Okay, so like, because here's the thing, I had a conversation with that about a guy in Warsaw, because it's the same thing in Warsaw.
Yeah.
Look, there are, unfortunately, and I have very, very, very little sympathy for these guys who Ukraine used to be a fabulously, fabulously corrupt country. We should, if you ever come to Ukraine, come to a place called Mishiheria. It's the residence of the former pro-Russian president Yanukovych. It is obscenely opulent. It's a modern-day Versailles. He stole something like $30 billion from the Ukrainian coffers. It has a, you know, 10 million euro chandelier full of gems and a, you know,
we're talking serious bling here, are we, Tom? We're talking serious bad taste bling.
Obscene bling, you know, his own cryotherapy chamber and like a private boxing ring and a pirate ship on a lake. It was absurd. And it's now a museum of corruption. There were a lot of very wealthy Ukrainians, many of whom made their money from stealing from the public coffers, but let's just put it politely. And it really does piss me off when I see that, because most of them stole their money, by the way, well before 2022.
Yeah.
Right. However, many people see these super flash cars with Ukrainian number plates and they don't realize the historical context of it. And they see it and they think, ah, these are the Ukrainians who've stolen the money that's come into the country since 2022. That's our aid money. No, it's not. It was the money that was taken from the Ukrainian coffers. However, I think what these, you know, and they're usually young men are doing is a total disgrace. I think most people in Ukraine agree it's a total disgrace that these guys are trying to, I don't know, show off to pick up foreign girls, try and show off to foreign girls or something, their wealth and their status, when the rest of the country is fighting an existential war for survival. It's an absolute disgrace.
And what's day to day in Kyiv then? I mean, they seem to go through, I mean, apart from the, you know, the unbelievable success of this drone raid on, you know, on the Russians, which was like gobsmackingly brilliant and wiping out the, you know, the bomb, nuclear bombers and et cetera, you know, $250 drones and all that sort of thing. I mean, are there still little celebrations going on? Has Kyiv turned to, because it's not going to get invaded, it's not going to get nuked. I mean, is it sort of an instatus, like, here we go, another day? You're in a war zone, but you're not in a war zone, if you see what I mean. Being front line, but still at any minute, you could get a hypersonic attack or something like that.
I have a full chapter about this in my book.
Yeah.
Chapter 7, it's called In the Mood for Love. It's based on a sort of an old, it's based on a quite famous Hong Kong film. And I had a girlfriend, a Ukrainian girlfriend who left Kyiv, but she left Kyiv after the battle had gone through. She said she didn't want to be, she wanted it to be her choice to leave. And on our last evening together, we watched that film. And so, and what it's about is it's called Kyiv, the subtitle is Kyiv, but in the blur between peace and war, because both things are kind of there. And if you just walk down the street, you won't really notice there's war on, right? You'll see there are some posters that try and recruit you to join the army. There's a few sandbags like in front of the windows of like important buildings and stuff, but there's no real obvious threat that there's a war going on. I'll share a little anecdote, but there is also a very big tension in Ukrainian society now between the people living in Kyiv and the people on the front lines who believe that the people living in Kyiv aren't doing, you know, enough to help the war effort, which is, I think it's a moral judgment that isn't for me to make. But I'll give you one example. So for instance, I have a little skit on my Instagram where I was on Times Radio and I was talking about how Ukraine still has music festivals. And Ukraine had a major music festival just the other day. You know, it's called Atlas Weekend. It even had the Finnish band Erasmus, who traveled all the way in from it. And it's really interesting because not only do you have all the performers on stage, there's a bomb shelter in the basement. It's in this big mall, and the bottom there's an underground car parking area, right, that's used as a bomb shelter. That is full of like displays from various Ukrainian military brigades trying to convince the young men who are at this festival to join up.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. They have like little video games. You can pretend to be a drone pilot and it show you how it works. They have medical first aid demonstrations. They have gun safety training. It's really, really interesting. And there's generally two things that they say. So I remember one when I went to that festival, not this year, but last year. Yeah. And I remember talking to them and we interviewed the quite well-known Ukrainian band. They're not massive outside of Ukraine, but everyone in Ukraine would know who they are, but I'm not going to name them.
Right.
And I remember we said, we had a quite nice discussion. And then I said, look, Ukraine is running out of soldiers. Have any of you guys thought of signing up? And all of a sudden the mood in the room just went like super awkward and super tired. And they were like, well, you know, we think we do what we can fighting on the cultural front line to show Ukraine's bravery and support and stuff. And the very next day, their PR manager called us and was like, please, please, please don't use that line. Yeah. It looked disrespectful. And I agreed, which is why I'm not naming them, but I thought that that was a good, you know, a good little...
Do you think when this is over, no matter what time, what form it takes, yeah, that that's going to leave a scar? Because you talk about the Iron Generation, for those who did and those who went, oh yeah, but I'm doing specialty coffees for the cause.
Absolutely. It's going to be a big thing. It's going to be a big thing in Ukrainian society. You know, at the start of my book, I have an epigraph from Blood Meridian, Cormac McCarthy's book. And there's just a great line in there. It's like, you know, war, those who fought and those who did not. There is this very clean demarcation that is going to be in society. And there is going to be a lot of recriminations, especially as, to be honest, a lot of those, you know, rich young men that you're talking about, when the war is done and Ukraine is rebuilding, are probably going to come back.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of the women are going to come back. And a lot of people who are in Ukraine the whole... Yeah, there's going to be the conflict between those who fought and those who stayed in Kiev and those who stay or whichever other city and those who stayed in Ukraine and those who left, right? And you know, everyone's going to be like, well, you know, one of the military recruiting posters literally said that I drove past when I was doing the research for the book, literally said, "Daddy, what did you do during the war?" And shows like a guy with a young child, presumably 20 years down the line. And I thought that was an ex. That's the kind of thing that I'm like, if I was a young Ukrainian man debating whether to join up, that would be the kind of thing that would make.
Yeah, I was sitting in a beach club in Marbella, meeting your mother for the first time. I ain't gonna cut it, is it, Tom?
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, when I go abroad and I sometimes meet Ukrainian guys like this, they are very quiet around me. They are very downcast. They are very ashamed because they know that I know what they're doing, right, that I explained to you before, and I think it's very interesting.
What are you hoping that people, because you've revamped the book, so what are you hoping that people, again, I mean, it's not about, you know, canine welfare in war zones, so not dogs and Maripol, but what are you hoping that people are going to take? Because, I mean, I said it's only been sort of 3 or 4 months, so is it, what are you hoping that people are going to take from the book? And really, should we be looking at your Substack as well for more
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, so the book has been out for just under 2 months.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm kind of doing my new media thing again is it's being launched in the United States. We're having a launch in New York in mid-September. So, you know, that's...
That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm hoping to get the Ukrainian community there involved. I also had a European launch in Warsaw just last week at the Ukrainian official Ukrainian house there, which was great. Look, what I want to what I want people to take away from the book is, and you know, there is actually a brief section on dogs of war. Specifically, I'm talking about I have a section on sniffer dogs,
right,
and how sniffer dogs are important for, you know, old territory, like, you know, demining old territories and stuff like that. You know, territories that have been liberated and stuff.
Yeah.
What I want people to take away from it more than anything is I want to take away, one, just how big and how brutal this war has been for Ukraine, just how much of a whole society effort there has been in Ukraine to get the war, you know, to really come together and go all out to fight the Russian invasion. The other thing I really want people to think about, and this is why I have quite a few people who I kind of contrast their lives before the war and after the war, is, well, this could happen to anyone, right? You know, and the example I keep coming back to is Katerina, the young woman who was like a blogger that I met in a cafe a month before the war started. And then I saw her a year and a half later when she was like in an artillery brigade in Bakhmut. These people could be, you know, it's like, it's just your luck and circumstance that it isn't.
If people want to follow you on the socials, I've only got 6 seconds. People want to follow you on the socials, where they find you?
At NTMuch on X, and my Substack is called Dust and Echoes.